Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I mentioned at the top of the hour that the temperature is predicted to reach 51 degrees today. I would like to amend that. Apparently, it's 56 degrees today. So what does that really relatively balmy temperature mean to our gardening ploys this winter? Joining me now to talk about that is Ohio's garden sage, Deborah Kanafke. Welcome back, Deborah.
Oh, always nice to be here.
And not any trouble getting here today.
Oh, gosh, no. Let's see. Roads wide open. No snow.
Very little precipitation.
No rain. Another crazy winter. And you asked the question, what does 56 degrees mean? 56 degrees means that all my plants that are semi-evergreen look just fine. I have green all over my garden. I have my irises resprouting. I have new growth coming up from the crowns of some of my other plants.
My Swiss chard is still out there.
Oh, it's beautiful.
You know, yeah, kicking up, yeah.
Kale, collards, right? Our lettuces look great. Didn't even really have to put Rimé over them except for a couple evenings. And even then, they're fine. Bounce right back.
So these are all the good things. Yes, but is it good that your irises are popping up? Okay, because are they going to still be around for the spring?
Well, they will be if the temperatures then don't deep six, because if they go down, then that tender top growth is going to die. And then when the tender top growth dies, that means that some of that energy from that rhizome is gone. And if the rhizome is healthy, you'll get more top growth coming back when the temperatures are better. But if the rhizome is, say, a skinny rhizome, or for some reason the iris borer got to it, then that could mean that's the end of that particular iris.
Can you, if you see stuff like that popping up now, should you cover it with straw or leaves or something like that to protect it from a cold snap?
I actually did that with my colchicums.
Which are what?
They're a bulb. Sorry. they're an autumn blooming bulb, colchicum. Some people call them autumn crocus, although that's really not a good common name because they're not a crocus at all. Entirely different family of bulbs. But anyways, beautiful bulb, blooms in the fall. Its foliage usually starts emerging early April. This is December. So when I saw, they're up now about 1.5 to 2 inches, depending on where they are in my yard. And I took a bunch of leaves, because I stockpile my leaves, and I sort of frittered them around but didn't totally cover them. And they're going to probably grow another 1/2 inch to 1 inch if we keep up with this 56, 60-degree weather. If we stay over the 50s, they'll keep growing because they like it. That temperature is just great for them. That's why they're growing.
And if we then get 3 inches of snow and going down into the 20s, if they're not protected, I mean, what'll happen?
3 inches of snow is good because snow insulates and the foliage will be fine. So if we get snow cover the rest of the winter and we go to very deep colds, we're fine.
Okay.
It's when we don't get snow and it gets cold that all that tender foliage it's gone. It burns. Winter burn.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Ohio's garden sage, Deborah Kanafke. She's a author, a blogger. We'll post a link to her website or her blog blog site.
Yeah, we've been a little bit slow. Blog site. Yeah, we've been a little bit slow this month. I think it has to do with the season. We should be. In fact, I'm overdue. I'm supposed to be sending out a couple things to my fellow bloggers, and I just haven't gotten to it.
That's what I always think of Deborah Kanafke as a slacker. Seriously. So anyways, let's put her to work, folks. If you have a question or comment about your garden for the winter coming up this spring, maybe what to think about planting this year or how to plan your spring garden or what to do in the garden now, maybe this is some extra time to go out and get some work done that
weeding.
The real slackers like me didn't get done this fall. You can ask her now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We welcome them. Right now, nobody's called in, so it's
cool.
A free-for-all, and I know that Corinne hates it when I say that.
Okay, well, then let me talk about weeding.
Weeding.
I was out 3 days ago weeding. Because everything that's come up now, all the chickweed is up, all those little tiny beautiful rosettes that make the seeds that jump.
Those pretty mounds.
Mounds, yeah. They're up
everywhere.
They were
bad last year.
And there's so much seed in the soil. So I just went into a couple of my beds, and I just pulled a bunch of it up. it's not in flower yet, so that's good. And if you pull it up and put it upside down so that the roots are exposed to the cold, although we're not getting cold, but if the roots are exposed to the cold, they'll die. Okay. And these little mounds will go back into the soil that they've come out of.
But if it, an alternative is to throw it into your bad compost pile.
It's still good compost.
Oh,
the,
all right.
The issue is if you can see buds, flower buds coming up, you then think about it for your bad compost pile or take it apart. I often, when I weed, I break it apart so that it has to really struggle if it thinks it wants to go further and bloom and do all that stuff.
Yeah, that was the horrible, evil stuff last year that you told me to get out and pull it while I could, and I didn't. And
that's all right. I missed a whole bed. It's a beautiful bed of it now.
Fluffy green stuff. Let's see. Claudia in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Claudia.
Hi, Claudia.
Hello. Hello. My brother-in-law gave me some iris last fall. And I've been out of town a lot this fall, and I haven't gotten them in the ground. I thought I'd get them in before it got too late, but I want to know if it's still too late since the ground hasn't really frozen hard.
I'd say go for it. You have nothing to lose. If you leave them out of the ground, they'll shrivel up for sure. But if you put them in, and then if you have some leaves that are in your yard still, I hope there are, you can put some leaves over it, give them a little bit of a break in case we do get down to low temperatures. But yeah, do it. Give yourself a Christmas present. Spend some time outside. It's going to be a cloudy day. Yeah, cloudy, but 56 degrees, for heaven's sakes.
What about other bulbs? Do we still have time? Have we expanded the length of time?
You can put other bulbs in now. We're at the point where you might only get leaves and not flowers, although I have planted bulbs around Christmas and have gotten flowers. But it depends on what the winter gives us after you plant them, because the bulbs need to be vernalized. They need to have a certain amount of cold before the flower will come up.
So, all right. So what if it's a really warm winter then in general? Does that mean that even the bulbs that were planted this fall that never really get that cold snap that they needed won't be as flowery?
It's iffy. It's iffy. That's why daffodils don't bloom in Florida.
Oh.
Yeah.
And if I had a couple of perennials that were not put in the ground yet, I transplanted a lot of perennials this fall. Move things around.
Perennials are a little touchier. You're going to have is if you put them in the ground, you're going to, again, put the leaves around them, you're going to have to go out and push them back into the ground because they will heave with the frost, you know, freeze. We're having these freeze thaws, and they will heave. At this point in the year, I usually keep them in a pot and keep them in a protected location. I'm lucky I have an area that I've developed just for that because I do not get everything done in the fall. And then I have leaves that surround them. And so I'd say that's a 50-50 proposition.
Okay. Well, I'll see what happens.
Okay. Good luck.
Good luck,
Claudia.
Thanks
for your help. Bye-bye.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you'd like to speak to with my guest, Deborah Kanapke. Luke in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Luke.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Here's my problem. There is a weed that comes up, sort of a ground cover. It comes up every spring. It's very low growing. It has bright yellow flowers. And I'm hoping you know what it is and how I can get rid of it. Because it's only there. It dies back pretty quickly, but it leaves these annoying little tuber bulb things under the ground. And as far as I can tell, there seems to be no way, like if you spray pest, herbicide
Roundup or anything.
On them. Yeah. I don't think it affects the little bulb nodules, which, you know, they proliferate. And I don't, you know, I hate anything that's hegemonic that takes over the whole garden. And these take over the whole garden, right? So I just want to be able to get rid of them somehow, in some way short of digging up the annoying little bulbs.
Okay, I have the same problem. I made a big mistake, and I planted this cute little ranunculus. It's a buttercup. It's one of the buttercups. And if you go into some of our woods, you will see them all over. They've become a real pest in our forests. I think they're from Europe. And
that's probably what this is.
And if you look at the little flower, it looks like just a beautiful little buttercup and a little bit of shiny inside.
Yeah,
very pretty. Yeah. Anyways, at every single joint, leaf joint, and in the crown, it's like, I swear, a million of those little bulbils.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They just proliferate.
And what I have done is I have big black, big black containers left over from planting trees or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I dig that up every spring and I put them in there and I let them rot. And I just let them sit there and I put them in the sun so they just fry.
Hell for ranunculus.
Yeah, that's right. But the thing is they, like you said, they are so prolific and they leave all those little bulbils behind. You have to just keep taking it out. And as to poisoning, you can try Roundup, but they seem to be pretty resistant to it.
It seems like it just kills the leaf and leaves the little tuber.
Right.
The little tuber
bulbils. Yeah, they get left behind, and it has become a real pest. And I feel your pain because I'm battling the same issue in the back, and what I'm trying to do is just stopping it from spreading anywhere else. So I'm holding the line.
I mean, it takes over the lawn, and that's not that big a deal. Except I don't know, it's annoying. And then when it gets in actually among the perennials, how do you take can't really dig those out wholesale. So
it's very difficult. It got into my hepatica. Planting, and I had to take everything out, and I had to move my hepatica someplace else because it just keeps coming up. You're right. So you and I will be out this spring just digging as soon as we see it, before it blooms.
All right.
Okay.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
Take care. My guest, once again, is Deborah Kanapke, Ohio's Garden Sage. We welcome your questions or comments today, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Facebook's a good way to contact us as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the political power of the NRA after Newtown. Will a massacre of children break the grip of the NRA? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. It's 43 degrees in downtown Columbus with some clouds. Expect cloudy skies today and a high right around 50. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 46, and then rain, possibly a thunderstorm tomorrow, a high of 56. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, ready to assist families that have discovered over the holidays that their loved ones need help. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest today is Deborah Kanapke, author and Ohio's Garden Sage. We'll post a link to her blog that she shares with Michael Leach
and Teresa Woodard.
Teresa Woodard, so you can check that out when you go to WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Deborah, 614-292-8513. Amy in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, I have a question about raised beds. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to build a raised bed to extend my garden and, of course, give it better soil. I like to shop at Habitat for Humanity, their resource store, and I know that they have a lot of used lumber and things like that. Is there anything that I really should stay away from? I'm guessing plywood would not be very good because it might kind of delaminate.
Right, plywood.
With moisture.
Yeah, plywood's not your best bet because it will just fall apart. It would be make a better compost than a raised bed structure, structural piece. If you can tell about treated lumber, you want to avoid all old treated lumber from earlier than, I think it's 8 years ago.
Hmm.
And I need to check that because arsenic was used in it, and you just don't want that. The newer treated lumbers are much better. Did you have another question with that?
No, I would imagine I would stay away from treated lumber. But, I mean, I can use any other kind of lumber what if it's finished, I guess?
What if it's an old door, in other words? You could just cut that door, rip it in half, and you'd have two nice sides of some pretty sturdy, if you want to do that to a wood door, which, you know, is debatable, but just hypothetically.
If you could tell if the paint was a latex, I'd have no problem with it. I'd be a little bit more concerned about enamels and oil-based paints.
Sure, yeah.
And what would be in there? Your option, though, I know this may sound strange, would be to line that with plastic if you have any concerns with it. Put a sheet of the heavy-duty plastic between it and your soil. And as long as the soil is covering the plastic, then you don't get UV issues with it self-destructing. But, you know, I've used all kinds of lumber in my gardens, but I'm very careful about using older lumber if it's treated.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking often, too, those pallets that you see behind warehouses or, you know, at a dumpster or something like that.
Those would be great. The only issue there is be careful of your hands and the studs, the staples, and the nails that they use.
Okay.
And get your tetanus shot updated if you are working with pallets or anything that could have nails or screws or whatever in them.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Amy.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Kathleen in Springboro, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You know, I have a window box in the front of my house. It faces east, actually southeast. And I would like some suggestions for some year-round live plant material to put in it.
Since it's a window box and it's not on the ground, one of the things you might consider are some of the small leaf decorative ivies. And don't let it get on the ground, because if it does, then it's going to look for some place to climb and take over the world. So keep it only in your box. One that's really nice, one of my favorites, is called Gold Heart. It is green and gold, and it's beautiful in the box. So that ivy will give you some year-round color. It should have no problem. On the southeast, it could possibly get a little bit of winter burn if we have bright sunny days and the soil gets too dry, because then there's no water to come up to the plant and transpire water vapor. So there are some really cute little bird's foot, little tiny, and they're very delicate. And you can have them coming down the box. And then you can cut evergreens from your trees and stick those in. And if you have a beautiful, for the winter, I'm thinking, you can use decorative sticks to fill in. During the season, you can put some of your annuals in to give you a little bit more color. But the ivy will keep you going over the whole time. Is that what you're looking for, or are you looking for flowering plants?
No, actually, that's a great idea.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Kathleen. Good question. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from a listener. They ask, should I do anything special to winterize my Japanese maple? It has some leaves on it still. Is that normal? I bought it this spring, and I'm new to gardening. Welcome to gardening.
Yeah, welcome. So winterizing a Japanese maple, since this is an email and I cannot ask you a question, you might even email the answer back. It depends on what side of the house you put your Japanese maple on. If it is on the southeast and that area, you're not going to need to winterize it much. the issue is going to be if it's on the northwest side where we get our very cold winds. Japanese maples don't like that. So it probably would be nice if you could, I hate saying erect a barrier with burlap because that's just too much work, but be aware if there are any heaving, since it's a brand new plant, of it lifting itself out of the ground. And still having leaves with our crazy fall that we've had, I can believe that you might have some leaves on it, especially if it's in a protected location, on the south, southeast side, and other trees above it. So that I don't see that as being a problem if they are, you know, live leaves. All of my Japanese maples have lost their leaves. I do have a couple very young ones that have the dead leaves still sitting on them, you know, hanging on them. They haven't dropped them yet, and that's an issue of them being juvenile plants, very young plants. So I hope that helps.
All right. Let's see. Jan in Granville, you're on the air. Welcome, Jan.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about my garden. I get very excited every year in the spring to get my garden planted, and then I get things in, and then about the middle of the summer, they get these, like, I can't even grow squash anymore because I get all these little bugs all over it, and then, you know, they start on my cucumbers, and I really don't want to spray stuff. My tomatoes always get late-season blight. I just have such problems with insects and disease, and this year I planted eggplants, which those little black flea beetles loved, and I went out and picked them off by hand many mornings, but I just get very depressed because I'm not sure what to put on them to keep this from happening, or should I let my garden go fallow a year?
Well, populations build up in the soil, and that's why it's important to remove anything that is diseased or that might have eggs on them and put them in the bad compost pile. All of my tomatoes, bad compost. All of my leftover tomato plants, they go in the bad compost pile because they can have disease, and I do not ever use that compost. It just sits there and becomes one with the earth. So, as to the bugs that come on your cucumbers, we have a couple problems now. We not only have the vine borers, but we have the marmalated stink bug. And I know, I have some gorgeous pictures.
Marmalated stink
bug.
Who names these things?
I don't know. Well, it's marmalade because it's sort of like marbled.
Okay.
Where do they come up with these names? Yeah, you're right. But on my squash this year, I had the four instars of the marmalated stink bug from the, I found the egg and then the nymphs and then the adult. It was just great. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, I digress.
Means they're flourishing.
So I have a stink bug trap, and next year I'm going to have more stink bug traps. There's a pheromone that stink bugs like, and they just flock to it. And then you watch them die, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, but you know, I did that with Japanese beetles once.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it attracted Japanese beetles that weren't even there in the first place.
Well, Japanese beetle traps, again.
I will never do that again.
No, you put those in your neighbor's yard.
Oh, okay.
Not in your yard. But the marmalated stink bug will go to these traps. And you do have the issue where you could attract more. But according to the research that I found, is that, you know, that will pull them up into it. The other thing, if you can get the nymphs early, you can use some of the insecticidal soaps, some of the oil sprays. And I know, oh gosh, is it spinosad that people are using, or spinosad, depending how you say it, against these? I mean, it's a tough one. The marmalade stink bug devastated crops in Pennsylvania, has been doing that for several years, and now they're finally here. And last year, I got four zucchini when I usually am pawning them off on my neighbors.
You know, you've mentioned before about if you're having problems with late summer blight with your tomatoes, don't plant them there the next year.
Correct.
Always move your tomatoes around. Well, what if I only have a certain amount of sunlight in my yard to work with? Could I just rotate the what's there, but keep planting something there, but just put something different?
Definitely put something different.
So just rotate them around, and
yeah, and And Jan, just some of this, all of this kind of revolves around good garden practices. And one of the things that I was going to do this fall but didn't get to, I was going to get the hottest, doggone hottest chicken manure I could that stunk to high heaven, that was really hot, and put that into my vegetable garden. That's just going to have to happen next year, because I'm hoping that that will do a 1-2 first, kill the nasties. It will may also kill some of the good soil organisms, but it will also help build the soil at the same time. And if your plants are healthier, they can often withstand some of the onslaughts of disease and bugs. So the first thing you have to do is make your plants, offer your plants as much of a healthy growing situation as possible, which means consistent watering, building the soil, not over-fertilizing, but making sure the soil is healthy so the microorganisms in the soil can work on the soil-borne organisms. Also, companion planting, take a look at that. Plants that, and I don't know what the enemy of the marmaladed stink bug is. I think I'm going to look that up. Enemy of
English muffins.
I'm going to write this. And I may put something up about marmaladed stink bugs, because they are going to be a big problem for us this coming season.
And where can you get these traps?
I would imagine that all of the garden centers in town carry them.
Are they called a certain thing?
Or? They're called Rescue. Rescue is the company. Like rescue your plants. And they have a variety of different kinds of traps. And if you don't see them at your favorite garden center, then ask them what they would suggest, or can they get that in for you? But yeah, I think I'll put something up for marmaladed stink bugs.
On our Facebook page?
Yes, on Facebook page. It will happen today or tomorrow. And just because I need to do a little bit more research, because I know I'll be dealing with them next year.
Okay.
Jan, thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Kristen from Plain City, you're on the air with Deborah Kanapke. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you. Hi, Deborah. I have a question. I have a very large garden and a very well-established asparagus plot. And it's in need of transplanting for a variety of different reasons. One, we just need to sort of divide them, but also we have a lot of like grass and weeds, and it was sort of hastily planted in not exactly the most straight rows. How is the best way to transplant that? Because we've broken a couple of shovels trying to transplant it, and it's just so I wanted to ask you what is both the easiest way to divide, but also at this point, is it too late to do it?
Is it too late to do it? Well, they're dormant crowns at this point. And if you have the old stems, that gives you a good idea of where they're at. So I would think, I would not normally transplant at this time, but because of our fall and our ground not being frozen yet, and they're dormant crowns that you're moving, I would try it. And when you dig them up, you're probably going to have to go down about 18 inches. Like you said, you broke shovels, because the crowns actually, I believe they may be a contractile root, which means they pull themselves down to be, I don't know, how deep did you plant them the first time? Or did you just...
We probably followed the directions, and most of the directions probably 18 to...
And then pile the soil on top of them, right?
Right.
So you're going to be digging deep. And then when they come out, you know, have your trench already built where you're going to put them back in, put them right back in the soil, take out all that grass and whatever that has infiltrated that, and start over. They love compost. They love some ashes. So if you have a fireplace, if you have a fire pit, you can scatter some ashes in the soil, mix it in. I'm not talking about big handfuls, but just a couple handfuls that you mix in, and then you can side dress the area with the ashes on top, which is a nice thing, and then they'll just go down. They like potassium. So good luck with that. Digging, sometimes you have to dig a bit of a trench outside of where they're at so that you can really get underneath the the crowns. That sounds like a fun task.
All right,
fun.
Thanks very much.
Take care, Kristen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
An email from Rob in Canton. He writes, I haven't cut my roses back yet. Can I do it now? And how far should I cut them?
Roses.
Kind of depends on what kind of rose, mm-hmm. right? I hate that because I don't know what kind of roses I have.
You talk to 10 different rosarians and you'll get 10 different answers on this one. But here's my answer. I do not do a hard cut back on roses in the fall. I do cut them back to maybe 3 feet if they've gotten really tall, 3 feet, so they're not whipping around in the winter and breaking stems off and cracking, and that allows for disease to enter in the spring. Excuse me. And so I would just neaten them up and make sure that they're not going to damage themselves. I like to take them down to about 3 to 5 buds. Sometimes, well, 3. It depends on the health of the plant and how old it is. I do that in the spring, and I do that April into May. And the reason I'm careful about saying that is that we've had such crazy springs. I used to take down my roses at the end of March. But now it's sort of middle of April. And then if we get a cold snap, middle of April to end of April, I end up putting leaves around them temporarily and then pulling them away to protect the new buds that have sprouted. And when I prune, I always prune to an outside bud. You want to make sure that there's an outside bud on that stem that you're pruning, so you're not, so the terminal bud is not going into the middle of the plant, but growing to the outside. And I hope that helps.
Okay, Rob, let us know. If you want to talk with Deborah Kanapke, 614-292-8513. There are no calls waiting right now. So, you know, oh ye of little faith, you know, get on the horn and call us now. And you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back with my questions, unless you give us a call. After this, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley appoints Representative Tim Scott to the U.S. Senate.
He earned this seat.
Now, Hawaii's governor will name a replacement for Daniel Inouye, who died on Monday. I'm Neil Conan. Political junkie Ken Rudin returns as President Obama and Speaker John Boehner edge closer to a deal on taxes and spending cuts. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock for Hour 2 of All Sides and Health and Wellness for Winter Weather. That discussion from 11 till noon. And it's 43 degrees with some clouds, a high near 50 today, mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 46. Showers and possibly a thunderstorm for Thursday, breezy conditions and a high of 56 degrees. And then a chance of a rain-snow mix Thursday night, still breezy, a low of 28 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from United Way of Central Ohio. United Way is working to improve lives and strengthen our community by bringing together people and organizations to address local issues in education, income, health, and home. More information on how to get involved is at liveunitedcentralohio.org. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back. My guest is Deborah Kanapke. She's a horticulturist, a lecturer at Columbus State Community College, author of 4 gardening books, and with Michael Leach and Teresa Woodard, has put together a blog site, it's called heartland-gardening.com, if you want to check it out. We'll have a link to that at our website at wosu.org/allsides. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to speak with Deborah. We're taking questions and comments, of course, as usual. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Russell in Granville, you're on the air. Welcome, Russell.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
I have a question. I've collected a bunch of old cast iron bathtubs, the clawfoots,
cool.
And I want to make raised beds out of those for gardening up. a lot of trouble bending over. So I'm going to do like a basically a gravel base and then a fabric and then sand and soil. But I'm wondering, like, plants like tomatoes, and this way I can interchange the tubs and rotate. What do you recommend for, because it's roughly 18, you know, bathtubs, 2 feet wide by 5 feet, 4 feet long. If I planted, like, tomatoes or something on there, would you recommend, how much room do I need on either side? Would it be enough room to get a row down the center lengthwise, or, and stuff like rooting, how, I don't know quite how deep roots go in a lot of plants, cabbages, tomatoes.
So how deep are your bathtubs? You said about 18 inches deep?
Well, they're the old cloth-foot bathtubs.
Right, okay, so.
About 20 inches.
Okay, so after you put some gravel on the bottom.
A little bit of gravel, yeah.
I'm not so sure you need the gravel. So the bathtubs fortunately have a hole, right, so that water can drain out? Good.
Exactly.
I would skip the gravel and the fabric.
Okay.
I would just put in, that way you get the deepest root run you can.
Mm-hmm.
And for your tomatoes, 2 feet wide, I would play. I would do little zigzags. If you want to do two rows, the issue is going to be getting in between to get your tomatoes. And I don't know what kind of staking system you're going to do. There are some people that actually make a single stem of tomatoes and wind them up, you've seen the winding stakes, spiral stakes.
Mm-hmm.
I use those in my garden, but I'm not as religious about keeping them, you know, real tight. But you could do that. You could have dancing tomato soldiers in your bathtubs. I'm just seeing all kinds of wonderful pictures.
All these
pictures.
Images in my mind.
I'm just seeing, this sounds really cool, actually.
Tomato soldiers.
That's
okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not going to be so much about, you know, spacing. I wouldn't put them any closer than 1 foot apart as you're doing the long way.
I'm sorry? I was wondering about the outside edges of the tub. You know, 6 inches away from the outside edges, because I plan on mulching around the tub. I'm kind of worried about the sun heating up the metal and therefore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that could be an issue. Are they, what color are they?
Well, the tubs are generally white on the inside because of the porcelain, and then just like a cast iron.
Okay, so they're black on the outside.
Mm. Well, yeah, grayish metal. And again, I was going to kind of mulch around them to cover that up.
Okay, well, that's good because otherwise you will cook your tomatoes before you want to. I definitely wouldn't put them right next to the metal.
Okay.
So if they're 2 feet, I'd probably put them right in the center. And I put them 1 foot apart, so that means you could get four of them in there with 6 inches on either side on the outside of the four. And you can train them, or you can put cages, or you can just have fun. Do maybe put some kind of metal armatures up there and train them all over the place. It could be way fun. But
well,
I'm looking at four. I'm thinking four tomatoes.
And would it be big enough for an asparagus? I heard a lady doing an asparagus plot. Would a bathtub be too small, do you think, for a small plot of asparagus?
I would try it because you can grow anything in a container.
But you're going to have to give it a couple of years.
You're not going to get asparagus right away. Now, there is a book that you need to look at. It's called Bountiful Containers.
Oh, okay.
Bountiful Containers. And these two women put all kinds of vegetables and fruits in containers. So take a look at Bountiful Containers. You might get some ideas. It's a fun book. It should be in your library. If not, it's not an expensive book. And I bet it's been out for a while, so you can get it really cheap on the internet. Amazon or half.com or who knows what.
You're talking my language.
Yeah. It's a fun book, and it will give you a lot of ideas.
Well, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Good luck, Russell.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Grant in Columbus. Welcome, Grant.
Hello there, ladies.
Hi.
I have a question. I help my parents out with their gardening in Cleveland, and they have several small boxwood shrubs about a foot apart and I was wondering what is the best season to trim those?
For boxwood, what you want to do, you want to be there in the spring, which is a lovely time. It's probably in the, I want to say the May time frame, but you'll notice boxwood puts out its flush, and it's bright green, that spring green color. As soon as it turns to the darker green color of the other, that's a signal. This is a good time to prune. I will tell you, though, I've pruned boxwood in June, in May. I've also pruned it lightly, pluck pruned it in fall. If there have been, definitely if anything's dead, but also if there's something that's really kind of
some wacky
overgrown, little wacky side shoot that I don't want. I don't make
I'm sort of ignorant. What is pluck pruning?
Okay, pluck pruning. Instead of making them little ball, is this a hedge or is this freeform boxwood?
They're freeform little teeny ones, about 12 inches apart.
A pluck prune means that you don't make a hedge, a little ball, a little square, whatever. Instead, what you do is you try to follow the natural form of the plant, and you just take out pieces that are way outside of the other pieces and just shape the plant gently, branch by branch. So you're plucking the branch and pruning it back to where it sort of fits in with the rest of the plant.
Just a little haircut.
Yeah, it's like a haircut, but not a shear. You know,
okay.
Now, if you want to shear, if you're doing a hedge, then you are shearing. And that's a different pruning technique. I happen to have in front of me three pruning books.
Wow.
Yeah. I knew there'd
She's
be a pruning
true.
Question.
She does.
But there's a nice little eyewitness garden book on pruning and training. And they show you, you know, they're so good. The Dorling Kinserly books, they're so good at showing you the pictures. Plus, there's a great book by Lee Reich called The Pruning Book.
Yeah,
and then there's another one that I just picked up. It's nice. It's called The Pruning of Trees, Shrubs, and Conifers. So you can go to Half Price Books, you can go on the web, you can go to Barnes and Nobles, wherever, take a look at the books and look for the ones that have great pictures that show you exactly what you need to do.
And I need pictures.
Pictures. Pictures are good.
Yeah.
Have fun.
Thanks.
All right, Karen. Take care. Bye-bye. Charlie in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome, Charlie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I got two questions. First one is how to trim a grapevine, and the second is when to trim them.
Uh-huh, grapevine. Okay. I have to admit I'm a novice with grapevine, although every time I've been pruning them for 10 years, but I feel like I'm a novice.
Jeez, I was going to say.
Well, no, it's just that, you know, I've tried different things and, you know, I follow this silly little book and do, you know, these beautiful little, put it up on the wires and everything, and then part of it dies. So then it's, you know. But for pruning grapevines, it depends on what you're trying to do, whether you want an espalier, you know, a shape, or if you just want to keep them in control. I have a friend who has an arbor of grapevines, and basically they just prune them enough so that they're not running into them when they're underneath the arbor. But you do want to prune them back, and I'm going to also tell you to go to the store and take a look at the pruning and training book, the Eyewitness Garden books, because there are a lot of different ways that you can prune grapes depending on what you want to do with them. It's sort of like roses.
Uh-huh.
Are you growing champagne grapes for champagne, or are you growing an arbor where you can just pluck the supposedly many, many, many grapes?
The bountiful.
Bountiful grapes. And do know that when you have grapes, you also will get bees. They are attracted to them because of the sweetness.
Right.
So when do you prune them? I've pruned them. I prune them in the spring, early.
Spring.
I want to say in the April time frame, you want to do it, I believe, if you're pruning them hard when they're still dormant. If you're pruning them for shaping, you can kind of wait to see how they grow.
Okay, great.
All right.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlie. Bye-bye.
I'm going to put something up about grapes, because grapes, that's a big topic on pruning.
Mike and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning. Let's get weird. I got an off-the-wall question.
Oh, good. I like those.
you walk or look around throughout central Ohio or throughout the Midwest, and you have all these ubiquitous housing developments, and just about or a high percentage of all these places or all these homes have their own little four-legged fertilizer factory walking around. While it might be distasteful to talk about, you buy you a dog manure and throwing it in the garden instead of throwing it in the trash bag?
There is some hesitation on using manure from our pets because of possible parasites and diseases, especially with cats and I believe also with dogs. Now, if you were to compost it, really compost it in a hot compost pile so that you would kill anything that might be in the feces, then that should work out okay. But it needs to be in a hot compost pile so that you're not introducing something into your garden that you do not want. I would not put it in a passive pile and just expect it to be okay. Is that
one other question?
Okay.
I was just down south in South Carolina, and their garden stores sell atrazine and commercial strength, which a farmer would use. And they also sell calcium nitrate for tomatoes, which I can't find that up here. And I was always brought up with the belief that that was a pretty good way to beat blossom end rot. Any thoughts or comments on that, especially atrazine? I believe that it was not an over-the-counter product, but I guess I'm wrong.
I know my information is that it is not an over-the-counter product, especially the commercial strength. So I can't answer that one for South America or South America, South Carolina. Let's that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it was in pint. I mean, it was made by the traditional purveyors of the small lawn and garden use type of products, and the pints to, I wouldn't even say quart, but in the small, not a 2.5 or anything like that, you would find.
Well, that's something you should really avoid using. And then the other issue with calcium nitrate, there are commercial fertilizers that say they have calcium in them, especially if they're for tomatoes and other crops that what we're eating is the fruit. So look for those. I don't know. I've never used straight calcium in my garden. I've always used it in conjunction with other nutrients, which is probably a better way to do that. I know, although in the past, people used to mix their own fertilizers with different components, but I don't know about the calcium nitrate. I've not seen it for sale here in Ohio, but then again, I've not been looking for it either, since I'll buy fertilizers that have the calcium already in it for tomatoes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mike. Molly in Franklin County, welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Real good. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I have a small front yard, and right now it's sort of taken over by ivy and lemon balm, and I wasn't sure. First of all, is there something that I can do with the lemon balm, or should I just sort of clear everything out and start over?
I make iced tea with lemon balm, and I also cook with it. But
what does lemon balm look like?
Lemon balm's in the mint family, mm-hmm. so it has opposite leaves, and it has ovalish leaves that are scalloped on the outside, ovalish with a point on the top. And they have little, tiny, insignificant yellowish-white flowers, and they make a ton of seed. A ton.
Yes, they do.
So it's interesting, you know, that the lemon balm is probably living in between the little spaces between your ivy. You have two plants that are incredibly vigorous living together. So you can use lemon balm, and I have lemon balm in my own garden, but I keep it down to a dull roar. I take it out when it spreads too far. So, again, my big ones are iced tea and putting it in vegetables. Pretty much.
Would it be worth it to sort of get rid of all the ivy and, I don't know, like sort of, or let them live together? Or
well, it depends on what you want from your front yard. Getting rid of the ivy is a huge task, and the best way to do it, The best way to do it is, unfortunately, digging it out. It is very difficult to kill. And even if you do kill the top with Roundup or other herbicides, those rhizomes and those roots are very resistant. So yeah. That means digging it up where you don't want it and then keeping it, again, to a dull roar.
Okay.
With the lemon balm, you know, it might be nice to keep some of them, but it sounds like you need to get rid of some, too. So
okay.
Good luck with that and make some iced tea.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care, Molly. Email from Maureen. She says, my front yard is a muddy mess after installation of a new main water line. Do I have to wait until spring to seed, or with the strange winter weather, can I take a chance and seed it now?
I would not recommend seeding now. It gets cold. You've wasted your money in seed. If you can get a bunch of bales of straw, put that down for the winter, and then seed in that beautiful time frame, April 15th-ish.
Email from Jim McGahanna says that his cauliflower, beets, broccoli, Brussels sprouts were very, very slow growing this fall. He planted the seeds on July 4. After 140 days, the broccoli and cauliflower heads were about the size of a golf ball. This growing pattern is consistent with past years. I thought that the issue was soil compaction or lack of organic material. Have I incorporated sufficient levels of nitrogen into the soil? So I added about an inch of Comtil. Any thoughts on my situation?
We were too hot. I mean, that's the big answer to that one. Broccoli, all those cool crops are cool lovers. They grow best in the spring and in the fall. So over the summer, they just made dense, compact heads. Make sure your soil has a lot of compost in it. And the Comtil, you know, that is a soil enhancer. Whether that should, I mean, it's okay. I don't use Comtil in my food gardens, but that is a personal choice, and I've been assured that Comtil is safe. So big thing is get it started early, get it in your spring, get it in your fall.
Deborah Kanapke, thanks for joining us today.
It was nice to be here.
Deborah Kanapke, author, teacher, horticulturist, Ohio's Garden Sage. Thanks for listening. All kinds of great questions, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.